how cold the air can be, how he can be lost so quickly through the window of opportunity, just like a draft in the night. See how words can twist and hands can ring like phones inside empty homes when nobody's there to hear. Oh, do you hear me, dear?
Hi, you guys. Welcome back. This is Richard Sachs, your host on Lost Arts Radio, and we're going to be continuing with our special series, educational series on the history of the deep state with our friend Joel Skelfson. This week we're going to get actually into the war on terror. We were covering kind of the build-up to it last week, and the war on terror that was set up by the events of 9/11 that we talked about a little bit last time. And remember that you've got access to all five episodes preceding this one, and it's really a good idea. I mean, it's fine to just watch this one if it's your first one, but then go back and watch the other one so you get the whole thing in context and some of the bigger picture, and we'll end up putting it all together in the end. So I would suggest that we start by recapping where we've gotten to so far and then take it from there. So welcome, Joel, and let's get to our next section here.
Well, thank you very much. In the last section, we talked about 9/11 as a government deep state operation. And, you know, we covered the bare essentials. There's a lot to this. You could do several hours on 9/11 and its subsequent cover-up. But, you know, essentially the deep state loaded the World Trade Center buildings 1 and 2 and 7 with explosives meant to set off with not only demolition charges by electronic or radio control, but also thermite in the massive columns, which could not have been severed by demolition charges alone. It takes, they were so thick and so big, these 4x4 columns of steel at the base, and we're talking about 4 feet by 4 feet, that it required thermite to melt those columns. And that's why there was such a delay between the initial ignition of those explosives in the basement of the World Trade Center, which blew out the elevators and blew out all the windows in the lobby of the first floor, between the time that the columns actually melted. And so, you know, we talked about the molten pools of steel at the bottom, which was a result of melting those 47 big columns at the base. We talked about attack on the Pentagon with Flight 77, which had to have been a specially modified remote control aircraft, which exceeded all the G limits of a normal aircraft. No pilot could have flown that profile, and it had a rocket mounted on the wing, which penetrated the wall of the Pentagon before it crashed into the wall, showing that high explosive signature that shows up, and the missile smoke trail actually shows up on the Pentagon video. So a lot of interesting things about that. We talked about the role of Dick Cheney, who ran the Bush presidency from his vice president's office, how he was in charge of the 9/11 attack from the Situation Room and allowed the Pentagon attack to occur. We talked about how the Shanksville airplane crash did not happen, at least it wasn't Flight 93 that crashed at Shanksville, but it was taken to a hangar, landed at a hangar, and the passengers disposed of after they made these false tape recordings to simulate, you know, the fact that they'd been taken down by terrorists. So this was a massive operation. The terrorists just simply couldn't have done that. You couldn't have had access to the World Trade Center. You couldn't have had access to the aircraft. One of the aircraft, the second one that hit the tower, had this bulging modification on it, which could not have been done. And a pilot doing a walk around of the aircraft would have noticed, what is this? And would not have accepted the aircraft. So lots of different things involved in that shows that this could not have been done by the terrorists. You know, the Pentagon plane, because it hit the wall and the wall held up like a champ, according to one witness, and then it exploded into 1,000 little pieces, could only have occurred not with a bomb in the baggage department, with all the wings and the entire fuselage loaded with explosives so that it would virtually make the airplane turn into confetti-sized pieces. So tremendous amount of effort by the government to create this false flag. And once it had started then, we covered the fact that Secretary of State O'Neill in a White House meeting said that the Bush administration had already planned to invade Afghanistan and Iraq, and they were just waiting for the proper excuse to be able to do so. And then 9/11 provided that excuse. And so now we start the real war on terror. Immediately following 9/11, the cover-up starts, and the cover-up will take many, many years going through not only the 9/11 Commission, but all of the whistleblowers that came out of the wall that had to be silenced and had to cover up for those things. That was an ongoing story for the 5 years in the World Affairs Brief that I would cover from time to time. And just like the JFK assassination, you can have multiple investigations of 9/11, but as long as they're controlled by the establishment, you're going to get a cover-up. And the same thing happened with, you got a little more truth in the second and third investigation of the JFK assassination, but still the main story about Oswald still stands in the American psyche. So the first one to be attacked, of course, was the war in Iraq, and you had to falsify the reasons for attacking. First of all, they said that, you know, Iraq was involved in 9/11, which wasn't true at all. The only major Middle Eastern government that was involved in 9/11 was Saudi Arabia, which I believe trained the actual hijackers that the CIA hired and trained in Saudi Arabia on full-size airliners in order to take control of those airplanes. As I said, the false hijackers, the false names that were given, half of which are still alive by the FBI, were patsies set up to take the blame for it, but were never actually on the airplane. And that's why, of course, the government won't show you any of the videotapes of the actual hijackers getting on the airplanes. Those tapes are still classified. They showed one videotape of Otta, getting on an airplane, but it was not the one leading to Boston Logan. It was another flight. And the date timestamp was removed from it. So all kinds of cover-ups that the terrorists could not have done.
Joel, one question about that. You said that Cheney allowed it to happen, but somebody must have been quarterbacking and running it as it happened. Do we know who that was?
It's hard to say how this thing was specifically choreographed. We know that there has to be somebody in the Pentagon to create all of the training scenarios that were going on. They had training scenarios with aircraft dive bombing the White House. You can see one of those aircraft diving on the White House, a full-size airliner, as part of these exercises, and that was going on. And that, why was that important? It was important because the White House has anti-missile batteries on top of it. So you had to tell them, don't shoot at these airliners because we have a missile, we have an exercise going on. That's the only way that you shut down the air defense. And of course, the fighters were out on doing air defense exercises, but there did have to be several stand down orders given. One was at McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey. I had a military person email me after the 9/11 and said he was on duty at McGuire Air Force Base on the tower, and we got orders not to let any fighters take off as 9/11 was happening. Actual stand down orders. And of course, you know, you had to cover up for the various FAA controllers that were controlling all these aircraft around. And I covered in my previous thing the conversation that the United Airlines pilot overheard of, when the hijackers on Flight 93, mistaken for the intercom button, pressed the transmit button and told about there being a hijacking and a bomb on board, and that they actually saw an explosion on the Flight 93, which explains why the luggage was blown out over the countryside on the way to Shanksville, where it didn't actually crash. Tremendous amount of cover-ups in this regard. There were several follow-ons to the war on terror in the subsequent years. Now, I'll get to Iraq and Afghanistan later, but one of those was the anthrax attack. And the anthrax attack was a terrorist attack determined and engineered by the government. And they blamed it, of course, on a scientist, et cetera, and we found out that that was all phony, that this was actually a government anthrax attack in order to, they have to keep the war on terror alive for the next few years. Then you had the shoe bomber come up on the airliners. Right. And this is where a young Muslim kid, obviously drunk, was pre-programmed to be able to explode his shoes, which had, you know, explosives in them. But it didn't go off. And I don't think he actually had a proper triggering device. It was given to him. He was told it. So he was trying to light this plastic explosive with a match. Now, any trained terrorist would know that you cannot light plastic explosive with a match and have it explode. It burns just like a fire starter. And that's all that happened. Mm-hmm. So this couldn't have been a trained terrorist. And but this was made to create the TSA and all the inconvenience for people for years for taking their shoes off. And then there's this other false flag attack where someone was attempting to get liquid plastic explosives on an airplane. And it actually wasn't an explosive, but they made a big case. And so from now on, you had liquids less than a certain amount were banned from carry-on in an aircraft. And it was interesting that one of these false flag terror attacks, there was a lawyer from Chicago that was on this airplane in Europe and saw this guy who was supposed to be this terrorist actually ushered onto the airplane by an Indian-looking fellow in a very well-dressed suit, and he watched him go through. They weren't going to let him on because he didn't have a passport, and he showed some credentials, and he said, you got to let this guy on anyway without a passport. And so he got him through security, and this was clearly a black operation. So this is what kept the war on terror. This is what gave us all of these scanners on TSA, of which Michael Chertoff, the Darth Vader of the deep state, was involved in ownership of these companies which sold these expensive scanners to the United States government. And we're still dealing with this. Let's see, what else? We had the establishment of free speech zones during George W. Bush's administration, whereby when you would protest the government, you couldn't protest openly anymore. You had to be confined into this certain area, which you had no access to the press or anything else, called free speech zones. I mean, what an oxymoron.
Yeah.
As I said, Giuliani was also promoted for president after the 9/11 attack, and so he ran in the first election against Barack Obama, and that was a very strongly manipulated election, too, because Mitt Romney was running for the first time for president at this time, and he would have been much more popular despite him as being a Mormon and this fairly strong amount of anti-Mormon sentiment among evangelical Christians who were in the Republican Party. Nevertheless, in comparison to McCain, who was just, he wasn't going anywhere. He was below, I think, 3 or 4% in the polls before three major newspapers in the United States came out and endorsed John McCain. Now, this is because one of the main Republican candidates was not doing well, and it was Giuliani, who, you know, was man of the year after the 9/11 attack. And I thought to myself, as soon as I saw him on the cover of Time magazine, they're going to promote him for something political. So they were running Giuliani for president for the nomination, and he was just tanking. He was terrible. And so they didn't want it to accrue to Romney, who was in second place behind Giuliani. And so they boosted McCain out of nowhere by three Democratic newspapers coming out and endorsing John McCain. And then they had false polling that shot him up to the top, and he became the GOP nominee, didn't have a chance against Barack Obama, who they wanted elected. And so that was a major manipulation that we saw in the election of that year, I believe. And let's see, also, even during the Bush administration, we still had continued technological transfer from used aircraft and Boeing aircraft to China. And I had covered this many years prior to that time, how a subscriber who used to work for used aircraft said that we were very disturbed and complained to the company because we had Chinese generals coming through our factory and looking over our shoulder. And we made such a stink that used aircraft blocked us shut down the factories on Saturday and let the Chinese come in and have the run of the factories on Saturdays when we weren't there to stop the whistleblowers from going on. Well, apparently this was still going on by 2006 with used aircraft and Boeing. And the government, one part of the government, the white side of the government, issued a lawsuit against Hughes and Boeing, and that lawsuit was squashed by the deep state so that it didn't go anywhere. And that shows that the deep state still was trying to build the best enemy the money can buy, even though they couldn't get caught directly transferring. They were getting Hughes and Boeing to transfer surreptitiously.
So they threw out the lawsuits through judges that were cooperating with them? Or
That's correct. That's correct. We also had Fast and Furious happen at this time. And this is when the government under Eric Holder, Attorney General, authorized the so-called sting operation, where you would give a certain amount of weapons, allow them to be sold to the underworld, or in this fact, the members of the drug cartel in the United States, and have those weapons slip into Mexico. Well, it turned out to be a major problem because Fast and Furious let go 3,000 weapons, and they never did close the trap on the sting. I mean, you only have to do this once or twice to close the trap on the sting, right? Mm-hmm. 3,000 weapons, including automatic weapons. This was just an excuse to be able to shovel weapons out the door and to blame the gun show loophole for this. I mean, this is a massive conspiracy. This is the deep state working in all of these administrations, Republican and Democrats. Let's talk a little bit about the war in Iraq now. The war in Iraq had to be falsified by the concept of weapons of mass destruction. And the only weapons of mass destruction that Iraq really had were chemical and a few biological weapons. They'd never had a nuclear weapon. And before the war on terror, the Soviets had taken allowed those weapons to be transferred into Syria. So you had all the chemical weapons going out in convoys of trucks into Syria from Iraq. And still, despite the U.S. surveillance knowing that those chemical weapons had been transferred to Syria, they still used this dossier about weapons of mass destruction to launch the war on terror. Years after, General Colin Powell felt very, very embarrassed that he had been snookered into giving this report before the United Nations. He was a puppet person in the military. He was the commander of the artillery company who had covered up for the My Lai massacre. That's what got him into the deep state, I believe. He became a good cover-up artist, and once you cover up for something, you become blackmailable and eligible to work on other things. The war in Iraq was precipitated by the invasion into Kuwait from Iraq, but that was green-lighted by the United States. The ambassador to Iraq, April Glaspie, had responded when the Iraqi government said, how would the U.S. look upon our taking back our oil interest in Kuwait through an invasion? And she said the U.S. would have no objection. So that was a green light to the war on Iraq because the U.S. wanted an excuse. They really couldn't justify the fact that even though they were blaming Iraq for the war on terror, they really didn't have the evidence. And so they really needed the invasion of Kuwait in order to justify this war on Iraq. Iraq had a non-aggression or an alliance with Russia to come and support them in the case that the U.S. would attack them, and Russia did not honor that. They made a few flights of resupply into Iraq at the beginning days of the war, but that was it. During the war itself, they made no effort to stop the U.S. And the reason for that was that the Russians put in a lot of surveillance equipment to surveil and track all of the U.S. electronic jamming equipment that they used against the Iraqi Russian-built air interceptors. And because of that recording of U.S. jamming frequencies and our techniques, they were able to develop countermeasures. The Russians also developed anti-tank measures and other anti-weapon measures that they tried out in Iraq. In other words, they're using it as a test bed and were actually active in there. There was one Abrams U.S. tank that was taken out by a pencil-sized penetrator that penetrated all through 16 inches of armor and destroyed the crew on the inside. And that's now an open weapon, but it was first tested in the war in Iraq very successfully by Russia. And it's a small rod-type tungsten rod with a shaped charge in front of it that kind of blows a hole right through the tank, no bigger than a pencil. It's just a tremendous weapon, and they practiced on U.S. tanks during the Iraq War.
Sounds almost like a remote welding tool or something like that.
Right.
Before you go on, I don't want to lose the train of thought, but you mentioned when Iraq was basically given permission to attack Kuwait by U.S. Interests. And just so that people don't think Iraq just went crazy and attacked Kuwait for no reason or just to be bad, why, from the Iraqi point of view, did they want to go in and invade Kuwait?
Well, the problem was the oil field that was sitting under the border between Kuwait and Iraq, and they kind of had an agreement that you just take your share, and Kuwait was pumping more oil than their share. In other words, draining the oil field on their side. And so the Iraqis were justifiably very irritated with the Kuwaitis. And I think the Kuwaitis violated their agreement on inducement from the U.S. that will protect you. There's all kinds of secret deals.
As part of the setup for the invasion, in other words.
That's right. In other words, antagonize Iraq so that you can invade that. But, you know, they made all of this thing about Iraq being, you know, under a dictatorship. And Saddam Hussein was a dictator. He did arrest a lot of his opposition, etc. But, you know, it's in war, the war in Iraq made things much, much worse in Iraq than they ever were before. Everyone in Iraq now regrets the day that the Americans ever came in, because it's been a mess. I mean, Iraq, yeah, it's had its civil liberty problems, but boy, it was doing well economically. It had a lot of oil income coming in, and Iraq kept the Shiites and the Kurds and the Sunnis apart so that they didn't, you know, kill each other. But as soon as the war started, you had all of these factions saying, we're going to piggyback on the Americans and take charge of Iraq. The Kurds helped fight Saddam Hussein on behalf of the Americans. And I think they were promised this secretly, then they wanted their independence. And the U.S. betrayed them, wouldn't give Kurdistan its independence, even though at least half of the oil in Iraq is up there in Kurdistan. Then there's the Sunni Shiite battles during that. And the only reason that the U.S. won the war is they basically paid off the opposition side with millions of dollars in $100 bills that were carried in on pallets and distributed. So they bought off the war. We never really would have won the war in Iraq any more than the war in Afghanistan, except for buying off the various forces. And even still, after winning the war in Iraq, we never left. We had no intention of leaving Iraq. And that's why we built the biggest embassy in the world in the Green Zone in Iraq. And it's used to basically operate the pipeline to fund the war on terror. All of the weapons that come in from Bulgaria and other things first go to, or at least they're coordinated out of this embassy. They have thousands of people working in the embassy coordinating weapons distribution around the world, and those weapons are going to ISIS and the rebels. And a lot of times they use several surreptitious pipelines. One of them is Silkways Airline out of Azerbaijan that has carried over 300 flights of weapons into Syria under the cover of diplomatic immunity. I mean, how do you get away with diplomatic immunity as if this is diplomatic courier things and you're carrying in tons and tons of weapons? And Dilyana, the Bulgarian journalist Dilyana Detansheva, was the one who really uncovered. She got into Syria and photographed all these after the Syrian government, with the help of the Russians, had overcome a lot of the Syrian rebels and the ISIS rebels. They found whole warehouses with U.S. weaponry and Eastern European weaponry, and all of the tracing of those weapons led back to Bulgaria and Romania through Silkways Airline, and they had paperwork there with U.S. government statistics, U.S. stamps on it, you know, authorizing his diplomatic baggage. I mean, it was a telltale revelation, a fact of the deep state was arming not only their Syrian-backed rebels, but also ISIS. And by the way, there's no difference.
That was my question. What's the difference between the two?
The only difference is that the U.S. took about 50% of the Syrian-backed rebels, and they just did a name change. So you're now called ISIS. And they gave them new leaders and preference on it. And let me go through the background of why this happened and how this happened.
Okay.
The main target in the Middle East, after the destruction of Iraq and the invasion of Afghanistan, and you know, the invasion of Afghanistan's injury has been the longest war that the United States has ever been involved in. It's absolutely unwinnable. No one's ever beat the Taliban in the mountains. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in the main to take possession of the heroin traffic out of Afghanistan, which had previously had gone under the Soviets. And the Soviets were marketing that heroin through Europe, through Albania, and then northward through their control of the various Slavic countries. The U.S. wanted control of that because they use heroin money and drug trafficking not only to corrupt Western society, which is a part of the globalist agenda, but also to gain the money for it, because that's how they fund a lot of the black operations, is through money derived from drug trafficking.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the end target of the globalist intervention in the Middle East has been Iran. And why Iran? Because Iran is the only Muslim country that is capable of and well on the way to become self-sufficient in all kinds of weaponry. Now, as you'll remember, the Muslims and the Arabs have always been cannon fodder for the West in the battles of the Middle East. In World War I, Lawrence of Arabia, they promised all of these nations that they would be separate nations, and instead of giving them their independence, the U.S. carved them up into various, they carved up Iraq and put three conflicting people into Iraq: the Sunnis, the Kurds, and the Shiites, all right? And they did the same thing in Syria. Syria they carved up, and they put Kurds in there mixed up with Shiites and Sunnis. In Turkey, they put some Kurds into Turkey, etc. And so you had the perfect recipe for future conflict by creating unnatural boundaries between ethnic groups that would create tension in the future. But there was one country that was not a cobbled together, that was Iran, pretty homogeneous in terms of their Muslim heritage, etc., and their religion. And that became the target because Iran, being very, very suspicious of the Western allies and what they saw happen to Saudi Arabia and Syria during World War I, decided that we are going to be independent. We're going to be independent of both East and West in terms of weapons. And that's why they started developing their own tanks, their own missiles. A lot of this started during the Shah of Iran, but he bought a lot of American weapons like F-14 Tomcats. And as soon as the U.S. cut off those weapons supply when the Ayatollah took over, and that's a conspiracy in and of itself. The Ayatollah Khomeini was kept in a Paris villa for years in exile, waiting to come back into Iran, and that villa was paid for by the CIA through secret funds. And so even while the U.S. was supporting the Shah, they were paying for the Ayatollah to come in once they decided to dump the Shah, which they did. Just like Batista in Cuba, just like Somoza in Nicaragua, the Shah was eventually overthrown by the U.S. government. In fact, he got in because the U.S. overthrew another ruler in Iran. The U.S. has been involved in Iranian politics for many, many years because it's a very rich oil country and it has a very high-tech industry capable of creating nuclear weapons. I believe that Iran has always wanted to create nuclear weapons, but in fact, one of the interesting conspiracies involved in that is that the CIA actually gave Iran the original plans to the nuclear weapons, but they were altered so that a portion of the plans were flawed so that they could not work. Mm. And the Iranians went around the Americans and got those plans corrected by the French so that they could begin a nuclear weapons program. But the whole reason why the CIA, and this was through the Pakistani CIA network, gave those new plans to nuclear weapons to Iran was so that they could attack Iran, so that they could justify destroying Iran. So they were setting them up for an invasion. Well, Iran got those plans corrected by the French, who helped them build their first nuclear reactor. The Russians then came in and helped them build another nuclear reactor. They learned about centrifuges and how to start to enrich uranium. And so the U.S. started in 2004 this propaganda attack on Iran. This is after Iraq. Afghanistan's been ongoing since then, but Iran became the target after Iraq. And that's one of the reasons why the U.S. didn't want to leave Iraq, was so that they have a base of operations for attacking Iran. Right. In addition, they wanted to have the troops permanently stationed in the Middle East, close to Iran, so that when they provoked Iran, they would have Americans to attack. Now, switching to the current times, you'll notice that the U.S. has tried several times during the Trump administration to provoke Iran into attacking, flying a drone, flying a Navy surveillance aircraft into their airspace, and the Iranians, you know, smart as they were, decided to shoot down the drone, so they didn't give the excuse for the U.S. to say, you've killed American, you know, troops. But in any case, none of this worked, because Iran has been smart enough not to retaliate against U.S. troops. And because U.S. troops have not been bloodied, Trump has said, no, I'm not going to go through with this attack on Iran. So from the very beginning, the U.S. has kept troops in Iraq to make them vulnerable to Iranian attacks so that they can justify this war on Iran.
Now, Trump was encouraged to go ahead with it anyway, right? Even though there wasn't bloodshed.
That's right.
He just decided that wasn't a very good idea.
That's right. And so, you see, that's the case where Trump's instincts overrid his globalist his advisors. Now, let's go back to Iran, because this is a very important part in the war on terror. They had to justify the attack on Iran. And so ever since about 2006, we have had three aircraft carriers almost constantly in Iranian waters threatening Iran with attack. We even shot down, quote, accidentally, shot down one of Iran's airliners by a Navy vessel in order to try to provoke Iran into attacking the West. They didn't take the bait. The U.S. claimed it was a mistake. I don't think it was a mistake.
Right.
In any case, come 2007, preparatory to the 2008 election, guess who's running for president? Ron Paul, on a very anti-interventionist foreign policy.
Right.
So in 2007, the U.S. comes out with a new version of the World Nuclear Assessment. And they say in this Nuclear Assessment, National Intelligence Estimate, NIE report, that suddenly, after 2 years of constant propaganda about Iran building a nuclear weapon and threatening Israel, and by the way, the threat on Israel is based upon a faulty translation of a speech given by Ahmadinejad, where he basically said, is that he was talking about the leaders of Iran, and he's right about the leaders of, I'm sorry, Israel being globalist. And he said, you know, the leaders of Iran or Israel are corrupt and they must be removed. It did not say Israel must be removed from the face of the earth, but it's globalist leaders. And so it was a very direct mistranslation by the New York Times and New York Post, who made this a major problem about horror of horrors, Iran is going to wipe Israel off the face of the map. And it wasn't true.
It was just a political statement that they thought other leaders should replace the current ones, basically.
That's right. And so in 2007, the U.S. comes out with this shocking NIE report telling the world that suddenly we've determined that Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program. And everybody's shaking their heads in Washington and in the Pentagon. What do you mean? Here you've been telling us all these years and supposedly all this evidence, and now you say we've determined they don't have a nuclear program? They did this specifically to have an excuse to stand down their aircraft carriers from Iran, because they knew that if they went and attacked Iran, that this would accrue to the favor of Ron Paul, And American public, they had polled it, you see, was not willing to go to war with Iran. And sure enough, as soon as Ron Paul was eliminated by manipulation of the Republican Party of his popularity, falsifying primary results, all kinds of dirty tricks that they pulled on Ron Paul, once he was out of the race, 2008, NIE comes out, National Intelligence Assessment, suddenly Iran's nuclear program is back on and they're a threat. And three new aircraft carrier groups go back into Iran. It's very, very interesting to watch the globalists of this. Now, about this time, I think it was around 2009 or 2010, we got a piece of intelligence accidentally from a person within the city of London. And the city of London is not the metropolitan area of London. It's the small original city of London where the Anglo-American conspiracy operates. Okay, that's where they control the banking and everything. And there was this high-level financier in the city of London who was invited to a meeting. And we got into the meeting. They started to talk about Russia and Iran and China and Taiwan and all these globalist conspiracies that they were operating. And he realized, I don't know what I'm here for. I don't know what they're talking about. But you see, because he was such a high place financier, he got invited to a meeting because somebody thought he must be one of us. And he wasn't. So this is what I entitled the inadvertent eavesdrop into the globalist meeting. But he got an earful and he took notes. And he didn't understand a lot of it, but he talked about Russia and China being temporarily aligned, you know, to attack the West someday. He talked about how angry the globalist leadership was because Israel had not yet followed through with their promise to attack Iran's nuclear program.
Right.
Now, this is very interesting. We learned from this that Israel had, in fact, made a commitment to the globalists, not to their own people, not to... They were going to start a war with Iran. They expected Iran then to retaliate against U.S. troops in the area. That would bring the U.S. into the war. And they planned to obliterate Iran with air power alone, not to invade it.
Because isn't that a little bit of a flawed plan if Iran is an ally of Russia?
But the U.S., you see, figures that just as in Iraq, the Russians would not come to the rescue of Iran, just like they didn't come to the rescue of Iraq, even though they had promised. And the reason they know that is because Russia isn't ready to take on the West militarily. It's still building massive weapons of mass destruction and modern day fighters and Navy. It's still got to rebuild its blue water Navy, its submarines, its aircraft carriers. So Russia's got a long way to go. The U.S. knows that. They want to take down Iran before Russia's ready to step in.
And so why do they want, why do they want to do that if it's not the time to start the big war?
Because Iran, the war in Iran is never going to be, has never been intended to be the trigger event for World War III. That's reserved for North Korea. And I'll explain that when we get to that point.
Later on, right.
But Iran and all of the Middle East intervention is about creating the image of the U.S. as the bully of the world. That's the main reason. Sure, there's some issues about control of oil and the heroin and the poppy fields and all of those. But those are auxiliary to the fact that we want to keep intervening until Russia and China have an excuse to say somebody's got to stop the bully of the world. And everyone nods their head because everyone's tired, sick and tired of U.S. intervention. So what we learned from this inadvertent listener into this meeting globalist is that the globalists were displeased that Israel hadn't started this war yet. And what they ended up finding out from Israel is that Israel was refusing to start the war with Iran until the U.S. took care of Syria, because Israel knew that Syria had received all those chemical weapons from Iraq, had a thousand Scud missiles. They could overwhelm their Iron Dome anti-missile system by launching a salvo of thousands of missiles with chemical weapons into Tel Aviv and other areas in Israel. And so just prior to this happening, this was getting up to about 2013, remember in the previous year or two, the U.S. had started all of these color revolutions in Egypt, Tunisia, and Libya. Mm-hmm. Now, Libya was not a threat to anybody. Even though Libya was planning on bypassing the U.S. control of the dollar by getting out of the petrodollar and dealing with it. That wasn't the real reason for attacking Libya, any more than the reason for attacking Iran. And a lot of phony conspiracy theorists keeps thinking that money runs everything in the world, and it really isn't. These are satanic conspiracies for control and other things. The power structure already has all the money in the world. So
they use the money system to control the lower levels of bosses, though, I think, right?
And they use them, you know, they have to control money to enrich people as part of the reward system of joining the globalist government. And I mean, big money. They've got to buy off governments. They've got to buy off, and induce people to join. And Russia and China are doing the same. That's why everybody believes in fiat money now.
Yeah,
we can't do this with gold and silver. But in any case, Israel said to the global, we're not going to attack Iran until you take care of Syria. So they first of all started out with the destruction of Libya. And the reason they did that, above all, not only to take care of al-Qaddafi, who was in fact probably the closest thing to a benevolent dictator in all of Africa. He was using 90% of all the funds from oil revenue to turn back into his own people, jobs, education, free education. I mean, he was using oil money, you know, instead of building up. I mean, sure, he had his palaces and he had some gold and things and he had a military, but he was one of the few dictators that was really using the money to benefit the people. They had a first-class education and hospital system going in Libya. And all that was destroyed by
the system, too.
Yeah. All that was destroyed by the U.S. intervention and paying these rebel leaders to take down the government. The U.S. did the war on Libya by first starting a no-fly zone. And it wasn't a no-fly zone for us. It was a no-fly zone for you. In other words, you can't fly, but we were flying in cruise missiles, helicopters, special ops teams. It was an actual invasion of Iraq. And so in 2013, the U.S. decided, you know, upon Israel's demand, that we're going to do the same thing with Syria.
Well, before you say Syria, just so I'm clear, what was the underlying reason, if it wasn't to stop the threatened starting of a gold-backed currency for Africa and being apart from the BIS and all that, if that was not it, what was the reason to destroy Libya?
The reason to destroy Libya was to create hundreds of thousands of potential terrorists to be able to import into Syria to run the Syrian war. And so you'll find that about the largest percentage of terrorists in Syria, the so-called rebels, comes from Tunisia, the second comes from Libya, and there's a smattering from all the other countries before, but primarily Tunisia and Libya, the two countries that the U.S. destroyed by intervention. Egypt, probably number three, through the color revolution in Egypt. You know, you create hatred for the United States, and what happens? You got all these Muslims with some inducement by Israeli agents who are the best at training would-be terrorist leaders. They're trained by the Mossad in Israel, and they foment these people to go fight against the great Satan. And so, you know, they don't know that they're being funded by the U.S. The funding comes through Saudi Arabia, or it comes through Bahrain or Qatar, or in those days, Yemen, which was on the side of the global war on terror. And that's where the terrorist leaders are Arabs trained by Israel, so they don't tell anybody that we're working for the U.S. This is all to get back at the U.S. and to get back against. So they went into Syria to get back against Syria, which you know, the Israelis were especially interested in taking down. In 2013, John Kerry stepped before a London press conference after the announcement of a no-fly zone over Syria, meaning Syria can't fly to defend itself.
That was the first use of the no-fly zone against the country that you're invading, right, publicly? Was there any before that?
Yeah, Libya. They did a no-fly zone in Libya.
Right, Libya and Syria. Yeah. But it started with Libya, I guess.
Started with Libya, and they followed up. And so the reporter asked John Kerry in the press conference, he says, well, it's obvious by this no-fly zone that you're going to get ready to invade Syria as you did Libya. Is there anything that Syria can do to stop this? And Kerry, just off the top of his head, says, oh, yeah, they could give up the chemical weapons and we wouldn't attack. And Syria immediately said, we accept.
Right.
And Russia immediately telegraphed the US, we will accept on behalf of Syria and make sure that they follow through. John Kerry must have got a tongue lashing he'd never seen before when he got off that stage. You dummy, you ruined everything. You know, you just gave them an excuse. Now we can't attack. And so for the next year or so, the U.S. oversaw, or the U.N. oversaw the destruction of chemical weapons in Syria and certified, and the U.S. representative certified as well, that Syria had given up all its chemical weapons. Now the U.S. was in a tough area because they had no excuse to attack. They still had to take down Syria. And so President Obama set up a red line, meaning that if Syria uses any chemical weapons against a civilian, that we'll attack. And sure enough, within a month or so, there was a chemical weapon attack of sarin gas in a suburb of Damascus, which the U.S. promptly blamed on the Syrian government. Now, in the World Affairs brief at the time, I said very clearly, this is impossible. Bashar al-Assad is a Western-trained ophthalmologist. He's married to an English-speaking wife from the UK. He's no dummy. He's no ogre. His father was. Hafez al-Assad worked, had torture camps and other things. He was and so Bashar al-Assad was, of course, dealing with the leftover deep state in his own country, not related to our deep state, but leftover from Hafez al-Assad, who was an ally of the Soviet Union. But still, no one in their right mind would use chemical weapons. First, for military purposes, it's an area weapon for troops out in the open, away from civilians, because you can't control where that gas is going to go.
Right.
So you never use chemical weapons in an urban environment against when there's civilian threat, unless you want to create chaos among the civilians. Well, in any case, it was the U.S.-backed rebels that blew off the chemical weapons. They got them, they said, through Saudi Arabia. And that they did it. There was a whistleblower, someone who blew the whistle, leaked the information from the rebels' side. Of course, the U.S. press never covered that. They used it to blame on Syria. But the problem with the fact that Syria had complied with the chemical weapons attack is that the U.S. really didn't have an excuse. They were trying to use the rebels to overthrow, and they really couldn't, especially since Russia intervened at Syria about a year later and really turned the tide against the rebels, giving modern weapons and things to Syria and using modern air traffic control and helping out there. And that's when the U.S. created ISIS. As the war was winding down in Syria and Russia's intervention was at a stalemate, they created ISIS to have another excuse to get back into Syria. They took about 50% of the Syrian rebels and said, you're now ISIS. They gave them priority on weapons and funding, and they made two big weapons depots inside Iraq, and they sent them off to attack Iraq first, so it wouldn't be obvious that they were going for Syria. Iraq radioed the United States, said, we've discovered two major weapons depots. The Obama administration refused to intervene and remove or destroy those weapons depots. And so when ISIS started their attack, it was very telling. I mentioned in the World Affairs brief all of the signs that ISIS was a false flag organization. In the first place, they had all these orange jumpsuits that they were, you know, putting their prisoners, and they were beheading prisoners, Muslims, Christians, everybody. I said, what organization trying to gain a foothold and build a caliphate in the world goes about to create hatred against themselves with the whole world, including the Muslims? I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
Right.
They had faked all these things. The beheadings, for example, of the journalists were, to a certain extent, fake. Now, the journalists were killed, but it's very interesting, as I pointed out in the World Affairs brief, the journalists always gave a very non-stressed confession before they died. They said, you know, these guys were okay, we're doing this and that, and, you know, and this isn't really a problem for the world. And these are journalists. I mean, these are not going to be giving a confession uncoerced about ISIS, let alone. And yet they were on camera. But the telling point of these falsified videos was the fact that when the knife was put to the throat, and you see that before the video is cut, the knife goes and they don't wince. They don't. Mm. They don't go like this. And the reason they don't, and that's why the film is cut, is because I believe they were captured or freed by U.S. or British intelligence or Israeli intelligence, whoever was there, and said, all right, before we send you back to the United States, we want you to make a propaganda video about ISIS, et cetera. And we're going to fake your killing so as to really inflame the people about ISIS. And so we're going to fake your killing. We'll cut the film when we put the knife to you. And that's why they aren't wincing. Now, they were betrayed after that. Once the film is cut, they are beheaded. And the head is shown, you know, on the next video. But I think that's the reason they didn't wince, is they thought it was just being fake. Then the camera's cut and they're killed afterwards. This happened more than twice. So ISIS was clearly a false operation. And through ISIS, you had all these attacks on France, in other words, and these two were also falsified. I mean, the terror attacks were real, explosives were real, but these were mercenaries. We know this because you had the typical passport was dropped. Nobody's a terrorist takes their passport with them. You don't take real identification with you. I mean, you don't drop them in a rental car.
Right.
There was also this Mercedes-Benz that was shooting up. You notice they put it on an all-points bulletin for a Volkswagen Passat or something that the terrorists were driving. But here was a Mercedes of which burly, muscular mercenary types came out who were not Arab. Witnesses said they were white, and they shot up the restaurant, got in, and there was never any all-points bulletin put out for that Mercedes. So you see, that Mercedes was the deep state troops that were involved there. So all of these horrible terrorist attacks by ISIS throughout were meant to reinforce the war on terror. Everyone was getting tired of hearing Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda was never, and so all of a sudden you heard nothing about Al-Qaeda. Everything was ISIS. This is all faked. This is part of the phony war on terror, and it's all intrinsically involved with creating terror in the war in the Middle East, creating hatred for America by the Muslims in Iraq, in Iran, everywhere. So that's in essence what's going on in the war on terror. And I think in our next episode, we'll get into the most modern things. I want to mention one other thing that happened during this period of the maturing of the war on terror was the FBI. There was the London bombings were also falsified. These were not terrorists that brought bombs aboard these subway trains, because the forensic evidence shows that the bombs have been placed under the carriages and it exploded upward. The metal was bent upwards from under the carriage, showing these explosives were pre-planned and pre-placed before the trains took off and then remotely controlled. But in all the cases where either Britain or America, some 35 young Muslims that they captured and prosecuted for terrorism, in every one of those cases, every one, you had an FBI informant or MI5 informant, what we would call an agent provocateur, that was teaching, was inflaming his mind, giving them internet information about conspiracy to inflame them against America, giving them weapons, giving them the plans. They did it all for them. This was entrapment. They would go into Muslim mosques and get young, angry Arabs who didn't know what to do, and they would now train them how to be terrorists and then arrest them once they had started to do the act.
Right.
All of this is evidence that this war on terror is phony. That doesn't mean there aren't real terrorists out there, but they are created by U.S. intervention and hatred all around the world and the propaganda put out by ISIS.
Right. And not all of the U.S. personnel are in on the negative side, right? There's a negative side and a positive side, both.
That's right. But, you know, it's very tough to run this. I mean, as a Navy, former Navy pilot, you know, they had were given targets from the aircraft carrier to attack of so-called ISIS in Syria and Iraq and in Mosul. And in each of those cases, the deep state would alert ISIS to be gone. So those buildings ended up being empty.
Right.
So the,
right.
the Navy pilots don't see that. They know mission accomplished. We blew up the building. Mm-hmm. We estimate we must have killed 50 people, but they don't know. You can't see what's going on in the building. Another proof of the phony war on terror is the U.S. was allowing ISIS to market its oil through Turkey, and it was being purchased by Israel. That's why Russia bombed that whole convoy. This was 2 years after the beginning of the war against the Syrian rebels, with the Syrian rebels, and there was this convoy lined up to Turkey, and the Russians bombed it and said, this is what you should be doing, U.S., if you're really serious about fighting a war on terror. Now, Russia isn't our friend. They still intend to strike the West, but Russia saw an opportunity in the Middle East to intervene in Syria to embarrass the U.S. and to expose the phony war on terror. And that's why Russia has been relatively successful in stopping the U.S. overthrow of Syria. And that's the reason why the U.S. had to create ISIS, to have another reason to stay in that. And we'll take up that in the next session about how they claimed to destroy ISIS when they really didn't, how they saved ISIS leaders and their family and their heavy weapons after each battle, sent in trucks to reintegrate them into the Syrian rebel forces. It's just a marvelous story to see how devious these conspirators are within our government about falsifying an entire war, blaming 9/11 on a few hapless terrorists, when in fact it was a very sophisticated government operation.
They must feel like they're really incredibly brilliant to be doing all that.
Well, what they really lack in brilliance, and they're not smart. I mean, they have plenty of smarts, but they have power to cover up almost anything. So when they do make mistakes, and they do make mistakes, every time they kill someone like JFK, they make mistakes. It shows. You can't falsify completely. You can't falsify with the collapse of those buildings, including Building 7, with an airplane that didn't even strike Building 7.
Right. You just get the media to cooperate and not say anything about it.
Not just the media. In the NIST report, National Institute of Standards, they got top flight engineers to lie and create a computer program to falsify the evidence. Now, that takes power, buying them off. I don't know what it takes, but you have actual certified engineers working for the government buying into this. It's the same with the 9/11 Commission. It's the same with the JFK Commission. You had high-powered people, including a Supreme Court justice that was falsifying the murder of John F. Kennedy. You had the same thing happen with the murder of Vince Foster.
Right.
It's tremendously powerful what this deep state is. I'm telling your audience, do not underestimate Donald Trump, as sincere as he may be about draining the swamp, hasn't got a clue of how to do it, because he can't tell who's deep state and he isn't. And I'll cover that.
Yeah, he's proven that. Well, when you said that Russia was trying to help prevent the overthrow of the Syrian government, were they doing that because they understood the implications that it would lead to an attack by Israel on Iran, or were they just doing it because Syria was officially an ally?
No, they were doing it to embarrass the deep state, to embarrass the U.S., who was claiming to fight a war on terror, and they were exposing the fact that you're not really sincere about that. That's why we're bombing this convoy, you aren't.
And when you went into the... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
And of course, you know, they even got Turkish President Erdogan to change sides from NATO to Russia. And that changed a lot of the war on terror, because Turkey was the main conduit for these terrorists from Libya and Syria, or Libya and Tunisia and Egypt and Turkey, from coming into Syria. They were providing the funnel and the arms and weapons and marketing the oil. Israel was buying the oil. I mean, how do you fight a war against terror if you're buying the oil of the terrorists and giving them billions of dollars?
Right.
It's incredible.
You talked about the chemical attack also, and there were other chemical attacks, some of which turned out to be water instead of chemicals. And do you want to get into that some next time, or
cover that now? No, none of them were water. Some of them were chlorine, but like the UN report said, the chlorine came from tanks on the ground that were exploded, not from dropping from a helicopter. In other words, they were set off by the U.S.-backed rebels in the area and then blamed on the Syrian government. The entire hospital scene that made such big news about a chemical, when everybody starts to don masks.
Yeah.
You know, one of the guys from the hospital said, no, there was no chemicals. Someone came in and yelled chemical attack and everybody got on their masks. But there was no chemical attack.
There was another scene that was publicized with a bunch of people and kids lying on the ground, flapping around, you know, or unconscious. And the same kids were shown in video later getting paid off for their role in that. And they were wet with something. I don't think it was chlorine. And that's why I suggest water, because they were fine. So I'm just wondering about that.
Well, they had apparently some of these terrorists and their family that were in underground, underground caverns, and they did take some kind of irritant, whether it was tear gas or something, and put it down in there and then brought them out and filmed them, you know, writhing around on this. But it was totally falsified. It wasn't the Syrian government at all. As I say, why would Bashar al-Assad, a Western trainer, you know, use a chemical weapons act, knowing that that's a red line, knowing that that's going to hand the U.S. an excuse to attack his country when it's an ineffective weapon? It'll only kill civilians. I mean, this is just, would be stupid.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, we've got a lot more interesting stuff to get into, so I'm anxious to get to next week. Hold on, and we'll say goodbye in the break here.
Okay.
So there goes Joel Skousen, former Navy pilot, editor of World Affairs Brief, author of books like Strategic Relocation, The Secure Home, and somebody that we're really fortunate to get to be a teacher here during this series on history of the deep state. It has a purpose rather than just making everybody feel, you know, hopeless that the corruption is so deep. That's not really the end goal of the series. We're trying to get the information out there as accurately as possible so that people who do want to find solutions can get a feeling for what the depth of what we're really dealing with, what that actually is. And I thought I was a little bit educated about this stuff, but Joel's really widening my understanding dramatically, and I hope that's happening with you as well. In the end of it, as we get more toward the last episodes of the series, we're going to talk more and more about, all right, what do you do, assuming that Joel's prognosis actually happens, and there is this big war that he's talking about, but that it's possible to get through that, you know, without all the good things being destroyed. We'll get into the details of that. But also, what are the things that we could do just in case there's any chance to prevent this from happening, getting the information to the right people? What can we do as individuals that might support that more positive outcome? Things like that. So we've got a lot more to talk about still. We're not at the end yet. As Joel mentioned, that you can get your free copy of World Affairs Brief if you'd like to. What he and his writers put out every week, starting with a free copy at editor@worldaffairsbrief.com, and give you a feeling of what he's what the continuing educational material that he's giving to everybody, as long as it can be done. And I think that's valuable. Remember that if we disappear from any of the major platforms, which unfortunately is not that unlikely, you can find us at brighteon.com/channel/Lost Arts Radio. They're not going to be censoring anybody. And keep in touch with us at lostartsradio.com, our main website. You can also see the nonprofit that we've got that will keep us going and hopefully, you know, at some point find a source of funding for the more ambitious projects that we want to do, including building the school. And you can see that site at lostartsresearchinstitute.org. And if you look at the tab that says Eldamar, which is the name of the proposed school, one possible configuration of it is explained there in some detail. So if you want to read it, I'd be interested in your impressions. You can give me feedback anytime you want, richard@lostartsradio.com. And I do a small number of private consulting sessions. Those are available too. You can write to that same email address and get details. There's not time for a lot of that, but there are some. And then the club that we have meeting on a more secure platform for interactive discussion of all these things, and in particular, how to work on yourself, get your health back, relearn forbidden aspects of natural healing and lifestyle enhancements based on laws of nature that have been known and taught for thousands of years by the teachers who are aware of that stuff. we can talk openly about those things for the moment anyway, and about the consciousness tools that have had to be devised to make lifestyle change not a struggle, not something that you have to do by force and willpower. There's much better ways to go about it. So if you want to be part of that, if you want to be in on that level of information, go to planetaryhealingclub.com. Find out what you're really not supposed to know about getting your health back without the synthetic and invasive part of it. I can't give any medical advice, nor do I want to. I'm not part of the medical system at all. If you want medical advice and diagnoses and things, go to your doctor and get whatever they want to give you. But sharing information based on ancient, much wiser approaches to getting back to your real normal state. Join us for our live interactive meetings, and the small dues that are there help fund the nonprofit and keep us going, because we're not having commercials. As you may have noticed, we're not promoting products right now. I recommend things when I think they are probably good, but I don't get paid for it because I want you to know that I'm doing it because I actually think what I'm saying. It's not because we get a commission or anything like that at the moment. Money's great, and we really need money to keep going at all, and especially to do things like building the school, but we're not getting it from products right now. So there are small dues on the club membership that will help us, and access point to that is planetaryhealingclub.com. We also have a Subscribestar page at subscribestar.com/lostartsradio. That has different levels you can look at, and we have direct donation buttons that are operating at both the website I gave you for the nonprofit, LostArtsResearchInstitute.org, and also LostArtsRadio.com. And finally, just so that we don't lose touch with you, if we can't get this material out through the normal channels at some point, if you get on our mailing list, then we'll be able to send you whatever we're still able to put out. And Doug has set up a couple of good ways to get on that list. We just need a name and an email address for it. And you can email that name and email address to info@lostartsradio.com, or text it to a phone number dedicated to that, which is 928-235-4676. 928-235-4676. It's only set up for texting a name and an email address to try to get on our mailing list for future information. And it doesn't cost anything. That would be good when you get a chance to do that. Planetary Healing Club, again, is accessed once a week, but also people who get into it get all the archives going back to the beginning. There's a lot of information on there that we can't put on the public channels. And you can get that access point at planetaryhealingclub.com, and I'll meet you there on Saturdays. And it's pretty interesting stuff if you're ready to do some serious work on yourself, which is challenging and makes it worth your time to join us for the club. So I think that's about it. The show tonight will be followed by many more educational guest speakers on the Sunday night show. And then we have Lost Arts Radio Live, which is still on all the platforms that I know of, Saturdays at 4:30 Pacific, 7:30 Eastern time, once a week. And that show is different every week. Some pretty interesting information too, a half an hour before the Planetary Healing Club meeting on the private platform. I think that's everything I was supposed to remind you, and that's about it. I hope everything goes really well for you guys this week. Have a good time during everything that you're doing, and hope you can digest and get some benefit out of what we just covered. And I'll look forward to seeing you here next time.
Introducing Lost Arts Radio on Subscribestar.com. Just go to Subscribestar.com/LostArtsRadio to find our rewards program, offering 10 different giving levels starting at just $5 a month. We offer incredible value for any rewards level, from extra monthly interview videos not available publicly to subscription-based Planetary Healing Club videos once, twice, or three times a month, to private counseling sessions with Lost Arts Radio host Richard Sachs, to tech help with me, Doug Diamond. We even have one option where you can can be the star on Lost Arts Radio as our guest on a specially produced show just for you. We conduct an interview with you and broadcast it to our growing network and listenership. Our Subscribestar levels are one of a kind and offer great rewards for any budget. Please help support Lost Arts Radio. We can't do it without you. With increasing censorship on many of our channels, we really need your support today to keep doing what we're doing. As Richard says, we're not even at survival level yet. Lost Arts Radio has three weekly shows. Lost Arts Radio Live each Saturday night at 7:30 Eastern, 4:30 Pacific, which is a live stream currently on multiple platforms in case we get banned from some of the larger ones. Right now, we're on two YouTube channels, Facebook Live, Periscope, which is Twitter, Twitch, and DLive. You can access these broadcasts by going to www.lostartsradio.com/live for all the links to those channels. The Planetary Healing Club meets right after Lost Arts Radio Live at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific on Saturday nights. And our Sunday show with guests airs at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific on Sunday nights on our Blog Talk Radio channel, our YouTube channels, Facebook pages, and on Brighteon. Be sure to sign up for our free email list just in case we do get banned on big tech's platforms. It's just a matter of time, really. They don't like the stuff we talk about, and they do not want the truth out there. In fact, they have already attacked us numerous times. Join our free email list so we can let you know where we are and how to access our shows. The sign-up button is right on the top right on most pages of our website. The best starting point for all things Lost Arts Radio is our main site, lostartsradio.com, where you can find the hottest news selection videos that we curate just for you. Those are on the homepage and added to daily, as well as articles and breaking news about information you really need to know. Our show archives, the 10 most recent shows, are right on our homepage, as well as our Blog Talk Radio page at blogtalkradio.com/lostartsradio, or just click the All Things Radio Show tab right on our website. We're in the podcast directory on iTunes, and all of our shows except the banned ones are on our YouTube channels at Lost Arts Radio and at Diamond Disc. Our Brighteon page is really taking off, and we often have editors' picks videos right on their homepage. Visit brighteon.com/channel/lostartsradio. On our site, you can also access our free listener forum as well as sign up for the Planetary Healing Club, which is just $25 a month, where you get private access to a one-on-one interaction with host Richard Sachs and myself and the other club members who participate live. More info can be found at planetaryhealingclub.com. We're providing solutions in there to make the world a better place. Come join us. Stay tuned because up next, you'll get to hear a really great song by an independent artist that we're doing our best to support. Go to lostartsradio.com/music for the full list of all the great songs and bands that we spin on our audio-only podcast shows. If you're in a band and want to submit a song for consideration for airplay on Lost Arts Radio, visit my website at diamonddiscaudio.com for more information about the music placement, mastering, and mixing work that I do. Thanks again for listening to and supporting Lost Arts Radio. We love having you as part of our family to learn, experience, and grow with. How cool.
cold the air can be, how he can be lost so quickly through the window of opportunity, just like a draft in the night. See how words can twist and hands can ring like phones inside empty homes when nobody's there to hear. Until you hear me, dear. Black and blue, there are more than two colors to be here, and this history won't make me. Can't really just open me wide.